Hello everybody, it's me, Mrs. G, aka Claire Opsbird. You're listening to Extended for the best in aerospace news, views and interviews. Enjoy the show.
This is XTP Media.
But Lel is obviously my current favourite. It's got so much history to me. It's a gorgeous aeroplane to fly. I mean, the boys did such a good job rebuilding her.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 106 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. The Aircraft Restoration Company is a family-owned business that specialises in restoration, maintenance and operational services, especially warbirds. They've restored over 40 different types of aircraft, from Spitfires, Hurricanes and Lancasters to the Lockheed T-33 Shooting Star and the F-86 Sabre. Tim travels to Duxford in Cambridgeshire to talk to John Romaine about their recent project to recognise the National Health Service during the recent pandemic. That is, of course, the NHS Spitfire project. Recorded in a maintenance hangar, there's a little bit of workshop noise and aircraft background noise. We hope it adds to the atmosphere.
Okay, I'm here in what is that? Aladdin's Cave of Warbird Delights at Duxford Airfield, UK, at the Aircraft Restoration Company, ARCO. With one of the legends of the warbird circuit, John Romaine. If you've been to a British or European air show in the past 30-plus years, chances are you've seen him display and fly Spitfires, Blenheim, Leisander, Corsairs, and many more. ARCO, meanwhile, has raised the bar in terms of what restorations can achieve. They also provide deep maintenance for the RAF's historic Battle of Britain Memorial Flight. John, thanks so much for inviting me here. It's nice to be here. 2020 has been a very strange and terrible year for many people so far, but one of your Spitfires, in fact your personal Spitfire, should we say, has been raising morale in a very public way. Can you say more about this?
Yeah, it started during the lockdown period where no one was flying. There was obviously, we'd furloughed the majority of our staff, just like many other companies, and but from a family point of view, we had our Mark 11 Spitfire, was just coming to the end of a repair. And so we decided to, with the limited staff we had in and the family, that we would spend some of the lockdown period repairing her and getting her finished. At the end of that time, of course, she needed air testing, and we were allowed to carry out necessary air testing, but within 10 nautical miles of Duxford, which is obviously where we're based now. So we got her airborne mid-afternoon on Thursday and did the first air test. It all went well, landed back, and the phone started ringing. And it was all people who had seen the aeroplane flying close to Duxford, but around the villages around here. And they all called in support and just said, thank goodness, you know, how lovely it is to see a Spitfire flying again, and especially around the villages. So we acknowledged that, and we thought, well, actually tonight, just like many other towns, villages over the country, they were doing the 8 o'clock clap for the NHS. And so we decided to do the second test flight at 8 o'clock. Which we did, and my own village is only just over the hill from here. And so we centred it to that village and then did a few others where some of my other relations live, all within this 10-mile radius of Duxford. And the response from that was huge. I mean, people absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And it went from there, really. We then we did a couple more as sort of flying was generally released a little bit more so we could travel further than 10 miles. We did another couple of Thursdays. And then, of course, they announced, right, this coming Thursday is the final one. I think it was the 10th. And then we're not going to do them anymore. So we thought, well, we'll obviously do the last one. And then my son George said, but you know, what we could do, the aircraft is the perfect colour for this because it's, although it's in its PR blue, as it's known, it is pretty much the same as NHS blue. And so he said, we should write underneath, thank you NHS, for the last of the claps. And so we marked it all out, we painted it on with removable paint, and flew that last clap, the 10th. And of course the response from that was even greater, because suddenly now we've got an aeroplane that has got thank you NHS underneath it. We also flew around Cambridge and in Adam Brooks Hospital and the Royal Papworth.
Yeah.
And that was the first real link of the NHS people themselves actually having seen the aeroplane. Because before that, it was just people in the villages.
Yeah.
You know, but here were people that were actually working in the NHS that were seeing it and reading the message. That caused another lot of response. And so from that point, we thought, actually, we should do more hospitals. So we contacted the NHS themselves and said, you know, one, would you be happy with this? And two, recommend some of the hospitals who are particularly threatened in the actual pandemic. And the NHS did that, and we then sent out three sorties from here, covering off big routes that encompassed a number of hospitals on each route. So classically, each of the first three routes had sort of nine hospitals on each. And we did that to coincide with the 72nd anniversary of the NHS. Since then, we had more emails and more calls from people who wanted somehow to support it.
Yeah.
And we thought about that and thought, well, what we don't want to do, we're not looking for people to sponsor this aeroplane, we're not looking for people to sort of take any ownership of it. So what we'll do is we'll form a Just Giving page,
yeah,
and which we did. And so people now can go onto the Just Giving page. It's Just Giving NHS Spitfire. They can make a donation which goes to the NHS trusts together. And in recognition of that donation, they can nominate a name that's then written actually on the Spitfire. So, and that's caused obviously a huge amount of great interest from people who have wanted to have their names or the name of a loved one or the name of a doctor or a ward in an NHS unit. And they're being written onto the Spitfire as they come in. So currently there are over 1,600 names on the aeroplane.
Yeah.
And the fund to the NHS charities is going up by the day. And so we then thought, well, we'll continue doing this. So we now have lists of hospitals, UK, Scotland, Ireland, Wales. And we're gradually working through those lists to try and cover off as many as we possibly can. The response from the public, of course, means that there more and more people are going on the donation site. More and more names will go on the aeroplane. And so between now and the end of September, which is when the September air show is here at Duxford to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Britain, etc. But it's also a big show for Duxford.
The aeroplane will close the show on both the Saturday and the Sunday as a message again to thank the NHS, but also it gives people that are coming here the chance to see the aeroplane that their names are probably on,
because
they would have gone onto the site. And now we've got the news that the aeroplane will lead the Red Arrows both on the Saturday and the Sunday in a fly-through of Duxford before it then does its own closing show. So that's really exciting, and then once that's out, a lot of people would love their name on the aeroplane.
Wow.
The Reds. In addition, we did Silverstone Grand Prix, which was amazing, down the start-finish straight before the first Silverstone Grand Prix. And so a lot of people saw the content there, lots of the Formula One teams hashtagged it out and that sort of thing, which was great. We'll just keep going, aiming through till the end of September. As I said, the next mission is to go out to the West Midlands, which we're doing this week. Then we'll come back to Duxford. Then we're planning the route that takes us into the north. So we'll transition for as many NHS hospitals as we can going north. So we'll pick up York, Doncaster, all those sort of areas. Then once we're into the north, we'll cover the north and Scotland. We'll then cross the land over to West Scotland, do Glasgow and that area. And from there, we will drop into Carlisle and then drop over into Northern Ireland. The aircraft has the range to go sort of across the sea over to Northern Ireland.
Okay.
Probably operate from Londonderry, I would imagine. And then we will do Northern Ireland, of course, including Belfast, to eventually then leave Ireland, come back into Anglesey, North Wales, and then a route back to Duxford here, encompassing Wales. And then the last trip that it will do will be down into the West Country, so we'll take it down into Cornwall, Devon, Cornwall, that area, and then back here. And we will then have covered off the majority of the country.
Wow. And are these, when you do Scotland, will you be based in Scotland somewhere? Or you have to.
Yeah, I think initially there is ideas of basing at Perth.
Right.
And then when we go across to the west side, Kilbride have come on and said that, or Kilmarnock, there's a little airfield there that have offered their support to us, which is lovely.
Yeah.
So we'll base from that. And that will be where we'll leave to then go into Northern Ireland.
And is that a day's worth of a pure day's worth of flying, or presumably you get there overnight? Or
yeah, we'll have to once we go to the north. We're planning a 6 day out from Duxford, because the current ones we are obviously going from Duxford and normally back to Duxford. But of course, we can't do that with some of them now. So the last two that I did a couple of weeks ago, which was collecting the south, east and west of the country, we then went into Goodwood to refuel. So I did one sortie in the morning, refueled at Goodwood, and then we did another sortie in the afternoon. They were particularly busy ones. I mean, we covered 35 hospitals that weekend.
Wow.
So that was a busy day. And the others up north will be busy too. I mean, it's surprising how many hospitals there are. you know, we sit here in Cambridgeshire and we think hospital, Addenbrooke, Stevenage, you've got Lister, Welwyn Garden City, Queen Elizabeth II. But if you then branch out even around this area and you start collecting in a lot of hospitals, it's surprising just the number that there are.
I mean, you've told me this before, but just for our listeners, what's the reaction when you've been flying over these hospitals, you've been looking down, you're searching around them?
The first thing is I've got to find it. So some of them are easy to find. If they've got helipads and they're a big hospital, of course they're easy to find. And luckily the majority of those are on the outskirts of the big cities. And so you can pick them up quite easily and you can fly relatively close to them. Also that helps is looking for the ambulances. So again, big hospitals tend to have their own ambulance pool and you pick those up because of the bright colours that they're painted. The smaller ones are far more difficult. And some of them, you know, are embedded inside areas that you just have to sort of search them out a little. But you're having to do that from height as well because of, you know, the restrictions on overflying built-up areas. But once I've found it, then I identify where the people are. Sometimes they're all out on the grass, if the hospital's got a big grass area. The majority tend to be outside the reception area of a hospital.
Yeah.
But once I identify where they are, I then position the aeroplane so they definitely get to see the message.
Yeah.
So, of course, me curling around looking at them on reception, they can't see the other side of the aeroplane. So I go past, identify where they are, then I come back and do an orbit so that they can read the message. And then when I leave, I normally leave over the top so they can look up and see it underneath, and then I'm en route to the next one.
Wow, okay.
So there's a bit of display flying about, kind of...
There is, well, there's a little bit of choreography coming to make sure that, you know, one... I'm not flying over something I shouldn't be, and secondly, to make sure they get the message.
And do the NHS, your NHS partners, do people in the hospital know there's a Spitfire on the way? Do they get told? Or
they do. What we do, we're planning one right now for this Thursday, which we're going into the West Midlands. And I sat with Lucy and George this morning. We've done, you know, put the circles around where the main hospitals are for this route. We've linked it all in, found a position and an airfield to refuel at. Once we've done that, that is sent direct to the NHS with the route and where we're going to be. They then just push that out to all those hospitals.
Okay.
And also they push it out to their local press because the... You know, the local press of that particular area, you know, want to get it in their press, they want to get it on their radio stations, to just to make sure people know that the NHS Spitfire is coming.
Yeah.
And so lots of people know that it's coming. The feedback from the ground is great. A lot of people don't realise that I can see them, but I can. And so you can see people waving, you can see, you know, some of the sites, they've sort of positioned the ambulances and all things like that, which has been great. But you can definitely see them. And so the bigger response on the ground, the better. Yeah.
Okay. And so the total number of signatures you're going for is 80,000. There's room on the aircraft for 80,000.
There's room on there for 80,000.
And they're being personally...
Yeah, my wife Amanda is writing them all on. Doing a good job.
What are you? How many knots will this reduce the Spitfire's top speed by?
Hopefully not too many. We're using these paint pens.
Yeah.
And they've been given to us by Posta. I'll put Posta in because they should be there. And they've given us all the pens, and they work really well. Yeah.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics, and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
The Spitfire, obviously, it is a PR-19.
PR-11.
PR-11 with obviously Merlin engine rather than Griffin.
Yeah.
And as well as being an unarmed recce reconnaissance aircraft, it's got a personal connection to you, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, the 11 is not armed at all, so all it ever carried was cameras, which makes it particularly It's just the right aeroplane for the message we're sending out, because it never carried guns, so it was not a combat aeroplane at all. It's just a beautiful Spitfire that carried cameras. So it's right for this job, so to speak. I first saw that aeroplane when I was 10 years old in 1969, when it sat outside at Old Warden, and it was sitting outside the then cafe next to a Hurricane. And my parents were into going to air shows in those days. My father worked at de Havilland's at Hatfield, so flying was sort of in our blood. And we used to go to the Old Warden air shows to watch the old box kites and that sort of thing. And I have the picture of my mother and my brother and I standing in front of that actual aeroplane outside the restaurant. That was the first Spitfire I had ever seen as a young boy. And later on in my career, it just kept popping up again. So yeah. I then, at the age of 12, started coming here to Doxford as just a volunteer, sweeping hangar floors and working towards, I suppose, what Doxford has become now. But in those days, it wasn't far off the end of the filming of the Battle of Britain here, and it was just a derelict airfield with one hangar, which is what we call Hangar 5 now, with the East Anglian Aviation Society in it. The Imperial War Museum had got some aeroplanes in there that were just in storage.
Yeah.
They had no full-time staff here at all. It was just a derelict airfield with one hangar with some aeroplanes in it. And the Shuttleworth collection that Old Warden decided that the Mark 11 Spitfire that had sat outside there for many years should actually be restored to fly. And there was a team here who had restored their Mark 5 that had been used in the Battle of Britain film, flown to Canada on an exhibition tour, and then the Canadian Air Force flew it back into here in a C-130 Hercules. A team here then restored that aeroplane, and as a follow-on, Shuttleworth decided to let them do the 11. So the next time I saw it was when it arrived here on a lorry, and the then Spitfire team started restoring it. During that process, it was then sold by Old Warden. They needed some funds to keep Old Warden running, and so they sold various aeroplanes off, this one included. And it was bought by a chap called Roland Frazenay, who had the restoration finished at Trent Aero at East Midlands, and then he flew it for the first time and took it basically to France. He then passed it on to the Arnold family, so Doug Arnold had it, and the next time I came across it was when I was doing the first of my camera plane flying, which was on Piece of Cake. That
wow, okay.
Program that was produced many years ago now. And that aeroplane, it was then in camouflage, it was one of the aeroplanes, it was on the film. And so I remember it sitting next to me on many, many occasions. And you always knew it was that aeroplane because it's got the retracting tailwheel when the others had. So that was the next time I saw it. And then it went into storage for quite a number of years. Finally came out of storage, changed ownership again. And then the next time I saw it was in Rouen, when we were out doing a big show in Rouen, when it had an accident. It then came back to the UK, and it was made available by the insurance company, and that's when I bought it. And I then put it into storage until we could afford to put labour on it and the money, of course, that it costs to restore it back to flying again. And here she is, all finished, back in her original wartime PR colours.
And singularly appropriate that you're flying a morale-raising Spitfire from Doxford in the darkest hour for the UK.
Yeah, it's the response to Spitfires is amazing, isn't it? I mean, people, I don't know what it is, but they find attachment. And certainly putting the names on it has created even more of an attachment. So people, they feel part of it, which is great. You know, we had people in last night that just randomly called from a local village to say that their daughter worked for an ICU unit and
her name was on there somewhere, and they'd come and find it. So I said, yeah, of course. They came in last night, spent half an hour looking at the aeroplane, found the name, and got the pictures, of course, and they stumbled up. They said, we feel part of it now.
Yeah.
When it flies over, we're seeing it, we know our names or our daughter's names on it. It's fantastic, we love it.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So, you, moving on to sort of more generally, you said about your background from de Havilland, and what inspired you into aviation in the first place? You, presumably your father?
Yeah, my father was, you know, obviously he was into aviation, and so we were doing things, you know, he built model aeroplanes, and we'd go to Wheat Hampstead Common and fly those. When I left school, I was already coming to Duxford, and really what got me into warbirds was seeing the Battle of Britain film as a youngster. And sitting in that cinema watching, it was the Bouchons, or the 109s, that really grabbed my attention, because, you know, they're an aggressive-looking thing, and they were certainly aggressive in the Battle of Britain film, the way they were portrayed. So that really captured my imagination. And so from that, I started to come here to Duxford, and only came here because I wanted to see the airfield where the film was made. And then I found that there was an aviation society here. And so that, I then joined them, and I used to get the train up here at weekends from Hertfordshire, where I lived, and just started doing anything I could do. And as I said, most of that initially was cleaning hangar floors. They wouldn't let you near any aeroplanes, although in those days, of course, they were all static aeroplanes. And then things went on. You know, the Duxford started to get involved with flying machinery, and the first big collector that came here that I had any involvement with was Ormond Hayden Bailey, who flew in a couple of T-33 jets, a Sea Fury, but he also brought the Blenheims here.
Okay, and
Of course, then the link went on. We started working on the first of those, purely as volunteers for Ormond. He, unfortunately, lost his life in a German air show in a Mustang. And his brother then sold off all the aeroplanes. We, as a volunteer team, then started working for a chap called Graham Warner, who bought the Blenheims from the Hayden Bailey estate. My time at aerospace was gradually coming to an end. I'd ended up going through the apprenticeship, ended up on short-range weapon design, so it was Sky Flash and those sort of missiles. A little bit on naval missiles as well, so Sea Dart was something else that I worked on. Graham needed a full-time engineer here to really get the Blenheim project moving.
Yeah.
And so I left aerospace and came here full-time and started the process of getting the first Blenheim flying.
Mm-hmm.
And really that's how my full-time involvement with Duxford came about.
Do you think with your background as an engineer and restoring aircraft give you a different perspective than, say, somebody who's gone into world war flying from, say, you know, hooning around in the RAF at low level in the fast jet?
Oh, most definitely. And you know, having the engineering experience and knowing what makes these aeroplanes tick is a big advantage. You know, many pilots have had incidents with aeroplanes in the air where something is starting to go wrong. But if you understand what's going wrong and you can identify what that is going to do in the next 5 to 10 minutes, it gives you an edge, for sure. Yeah, it gives you a big edge. And, you know, like we were saying earlier, how many other pilots fly the Mark 11? There's one other, Mo Overall. He's our chief engineer next door. And, of course, he builds and maintains Spitfires day in, day out.
Yeah.
So if anyone's going to know anything about that aeroplane, it's going to be him.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And for, I mean, we're here at ARCO, so for anyone who any of our listeners who live on the moon, never heard of this, never heard of Duxford, Just explain a bit about ARCO, how many people work here, and also the difference between ARCO, Historic Flying Limited, and well, the new aerial collective over there.
Yeah. Well, I started ARCO back in 91. And what happened, we finished the first Blenheim, and it was unfortunately heavily damaged in a flying accident at Denham. And I was on board at the time, and that was my first sort of experience of how much crashing an aeroplane can actually hurt. I was the engineer on board, I wasn't flying it, but anyway, I came away from that with thinking, okay, I think I've done Warbirds now. So I've got a private pilot's license, and I decided I would go and get a commercial pilot's license and join the airlines. So I did that at Whitewater, got the commercial there, came away from that in 1990, and of course at that time there was no work in the airlines, so I've now got the debt of a commercial pilot's license and no work. So I came back to Duxford into engineering, and the first thing that happened was there was another Blenheim to be built. I decided then that I didn't want to work for anybody else anymore. I'd much prefer to work for myself, and so ARCO was formed on that basis, and then the Blenheim was sort of the first job that we did. It was just me to start with, and then gradually I took on, you know, another person and then another person, and as work carried on and we got more work offered to us, the workforce expanded. And we were then based in, we still have the workshop now, but a building called Building 66 here on Duxford Airfield. In its own right, it sort of became quite famous as where the Blenheims were restored. And we used hangarage from the museum. As things grew, there was then a chap called Carol Boss, who was a Dutch by birth, but a Belgian businessman, who had bought a Spitfire from Historic Flying, who were then based at Audient. And he came to us and spoke to me about possibility of us maintaining his aeroplane, which we were very happy to do. During that process, Historic Flying at Audient was going bust, basically. And so he decided to buy Historic Flying. And have his own Spitfire restoration company, which he did. He then came to me and said, you know, Audient is a lovely little airfield, but it's too small for us, and what I'd like to do is come to Duxford. So could we do something together and enable me to bring in the Spitfire restoration people that I now have, combine them with your maintenance organisation, and work together? And so we built the first of these two hangars, the one next door. We built that together, Hangar 425, and Historic Flying came under the umbrella of the Aircraft Restoration Company. And that worked really well, and we carried on restoring Spitfires. We then were operating, of course, all the Spitfires that Carol owned. Eventually, Carol needed to retire, and so Historic Flying was then passed to me, so I owned both companies. And then recently we've combined those into one, so that it's all now the Aircraft Restoration Company. Okay. And the name Historic Flying we still have and own, but we're putting that to one side now. Okay. So it's all coming under one umbrella.
Okay.
The Aerial Collective side is a relatively new venture, and that's all to do with flying the public in the two-seat Spitfires and Mustangs, and the air show side that we have always done, but we've always had that within the ARCO umbrella.
Right.
We're putting all the flying operations now across to Aerial Collective, and it's a side company to the main one, which, so we've got the main one doing all the maintenance and the restoration and all of that type of engineering work, and then we have a separate one which is doing all the flying ops,
right,
which is Aerial Collective.
Okay.
The number of people here, before COVID, we were at 54, You know, it was a busy place, still is a busy place, but of course we're currently having to cope with all the lack of displays, lack of flying. You know, a lot of our clients, who are also owners, decided, well, this year I'll just leave my aeroplane on the ground rather than fly it, yeah, for obvious reasons. That obviously has had an impact on the amount of work we do. So we've currently still got a number of people on furlough, but we'd look to get back into, you know, full productivity, so to speak, probably by November, as long as there's not a second spike.
Right. I mean, that was going to be one of my questions sort of later on is you know, sort of how has COVID affected the kind of Warburg community? I mean, no displays, no people putting off flying, you know.
Yeah, it's had some of the owners have, mostly the ones that have, you know, they've gone through their careers, they've just retired, they have old aeroplanes. And this has given them actually a period to really go out and enjoy their aeroplanes. And we've just heard Sean get airborne in his Mustang. And he's been having a great time because, you know, he's free to fly. He can fly. He can enjoy his aeroplanes. The airspace is quiet. There's nothing out there. So he is enjoying himself. But others who have seen that they need the financial input from display flying, they need the input from doing other things with their aeroplanes, and it's simply not there, so they're having to ground the machinery until it comes back, yeah, which hopefully will be next year.
Well, I mean the UK airshow scene has already been under pressure, you know, before the pandemic in terms of health and safety regulation and increased costs and things like that. What are your thoughts on when it looks like when it returns? And
I think it'll be like many things, it's going to be different for, yeah, sure. It could be, but it'll be better. I think there's a lot of different ways of doing air shows. The first air show that I did this year was the drive-in show at Shuttleworth, and I opened it with the Mark 11. And that worked really well, you know. And looking at the way people were socially distancing, they've got their car space, they've got the picnic, they've, yeah, got the, you know, and they were really, really enjoying it. And so there's something to be said about that. You know, should future shows, perhaps even here at Duxford, be just done in a different way? Of course, the big seaside ones, the Bournemouths, the Eastbournes, and everything else, I'm sure will still go ahead and be very successful. But I think the smaller shows are possibly just going to have to redesign themselves a little.
Yeah.
From our point of view, with our fleet of aeroplanes, it's, you know, it's an expensive thing to do to maintain, insure, and operate something like a blimp, and especially then when you start taking them fairly long distances to do air shows, when the, you know, putting a purely pound note sign against it, you come back and actually it's probably cost you more than you've just got back. So you then have to decide, why are you doing that? If it's the enjoyment of the aeroplane, it's the enjoyment of letting people see the aeroplane, then that's reason enough. But you have to understand that somewhere that money's got to come from somewhere to pay the bills.
Yeah.
And that either comes from people putting money in personally, if they own a, you know, any aeroplane, that, you know, they are all paying. You only ever really clean your face by doing air shows. You never make money from doing air shows.
Still to come on Extended.
Lots of people have compared Bouchons against Mark 9 Spitfires and the like, and I don't believe you can.
Are you fascinated by aviation and its history? Are you hungry to expand your knowledge? Then you're ready for The Aviation Historian. A compact format quarterly journal, The Aviation Historian is a cross between a magazine and a book. It uses the best authors and the best picture sources to explore the less well-known paths of the history of flying. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey, that's me, and Nick Stroud, so you can trust it for quality, accuracy, and sheer passion for the subject. The Aviation Historian. We're print, we're digital, but we're not in the shops. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com. Are you ready for it?
How many projects then have you got on the go at the moment?
We're just finishing
restoring?
19 next door, which I'm flying out to France this week. We've then got another Spitfire that's just coming on the blocks next door, and then another one after that. And so that's keeping the Spitfire team busy. And then in this side of the hangar, of course, as you can see, there's lots of maintenance going on, some of it in-depth, some of it routine. Of course, the two-seat Spitfires are busy, and so there's a lot of maintenance going on with those to keep them up to speed with their 25-hour checks, etc. We're also building new Lancaster tailplanes next door for the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight Lancaster. So we've got a team doing that, and Lancaster is due into us at the end of this season for a minor and engine changes and all sorts of things, so that will keep us busy right through until next April.
Wow. How do you get doing the BBMF kind of deep maintenance, would you?
We do the big maintenance, so we do the minors, the majors. We got into that years ago by just being offered one fighter and then one chipmunk, and it was sort of, it rotated through. You were just offered one aeroplane at a particular time, and we worked through those. They then came up with this idea that all of the fighters needed to be returned to a new line in the sand from the point of view of fatigue and the condition that they were in. And so the flight came up with a thing called a Major Plus. And so we had all of their fighters through on a Major Plus, which included changing wing spars. Any critical item on the aeroplane was either renewed or NDT'd. So that what sat outside the door at the end of that process was an aircraft that they could basically say was zero time.
Wow, okay.
And then they've moved forward from there. We were not doing, at that time, we weren't doing Lancaster, Dakota, or the Chipmunks. They were with other contractors. But then we were given the Lancaster, Dakota contract, and we had the Lancaster in for a major. Which we did a couple of years ago. In fact, this hangar that we're in now was built to enable us to do Lancaster. Obviously, it's big enough for a Lancaster plus a lot of other aeroplanes at the same time. So this hangar was designed and built with the Lancaster in mind. And she's due back. During that, the fighters, their major contract changed to another company. The MOD like to keep their eggs in different baskets, which is quite understandable. So currently we're doing Lancaster, Dakota and Chipmunks.
And it's a fairly small industry that you're in of warbird restoration and operation. Everybody knows each other. What would you say is the USP or the signature of an ARCO restoration? I mean, do you have pilots who can sit in one of your aircraft and instinctively know, oh yes, this is an ARCO Spitfire?
We do. We don't go out and say that too much, but the feedback from our pilots and the owners is, you know, they like what we do. You know, we just get on and do it. We're not a company that sits around talking rumour. We just get the job done.
Yeah.
And our track record for that is there. You know, a lot of... We're the people that if someone comes up with an unusual aeroplane or they want an aeroplane done in a specific way,
yeah,
they'll come here.
Okay.
Because they know that we think outside the box. We don't just... You know, someone could walk in the door with any oddity and we'd go, never done one of those before, don't, you know, that's going to be difficult, isn't it? We don't think like that. And one aeroplane in particular, you know, we've got that Supermarine Walrus sitting next door, which the new owner of it came to us. He said, I know you boys can do this.
Wow.
So
you're restricting Supermarine Walrus?
Yeah.
To flight?
Yeah. So, and he, like you said, I know you are the people that can do this.
Wow!
And so that's an exciting thing. We get a lot of pleasure from doing the different things and doing them well. That's where we get our kicks is, you know, if you're going to do it right. And that's where we get our enjoyment.
But it's not the RAF of the walrus, is it? They're not just having one put like another ISR aircraft in the
English. No, that theirs is at Cosford.
Yeah. Wow. So, I mean, this is an unusual aircraft. What's your holy grail of restorations? That if you found, if somebody said, "Oh, well, we've just pulled this up from a peabog," you drop everything, you know, out the door before they could. Can you get it flying? You know? What's your holy grail?
I'd love to do a Siskin, just in that, just because it's in that sort of mid-war area, and there's, in my view, there's very few. Well, there aren't many around, but it's an area of aviation technology that's not investigated too much these days. You know, you get all the boys that build First World War aeroplanes, you've got all the boys that build Second World War aeroplanes, but in the, you know, between the wars, there were some fantastic aeroplanes out there, Siskins and all that type of thing. Bristol Bulldogs and Gladiators and Gauntlets, and there's very few of them around, so
yeah,
something like that would be special. If you look at, you know, I'd love a Mosquito here. When I was at the apprentice at Hawker Siddeley's, I used to work on what was then the Hawker Siddeley Mosquito, which became the British Aerospace Mosquito, which of course they lost in Barton in the late 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So it'd be fantastic to have a Mosquito back here. And of course we're linked with the Pathfinder Trust, which is their whole aim is to get the Mosquito back.
Yeah.
And that, if it's going to happen, it'll happen here. So that's really exciting. Beyond that, looking at aeroplanes that are extremely rare, my father always told me when he was at de Havilland's, he said, the most amazing aeroplane ever was the de Havilland Hornet. And if you found one of those in the peat bog, there probably wouldn't be too much left because, of course, it's made of plywood. So, but to see a Hornet and to see one, hear one, and operate one would be phenomenal. But it's very unlikely to
happen. Winkle's favourite aircraft. You know, climb with one engine out, feathered, and it
phenomenal machine.
Yeah. So what's your favourite aircraft or least favourite aircraft of the current ones? How many types have you got in your logbook?
I've got 115 types. I've done about 4,500 flying hours now. You know, obviously, you know, over 1,000 on Spitfires, and got quite a few on 109s now. In fact, going back to 109s, I ended up owning one of the Bouchons again. It was in the Battle of Britain film, so it was quite unique to think that it was that got me into this. And there is our lovely 109 sitting there. What is my favourite? You know, some people say whichever one I'm climbing in on the day, and sometimes that's true. But Lel is obviously my current favourite. It's got so much history to me. It's a gorgeous aeroplane to fly. I mean, the boys did such a good job rebuilding her. But my first fighter was a Corsair, so I've still got a big soft spot for Corsairs.
The Blenheim, of course, if you get into the Twins, is again a completely unique experience.
Yeah.
B-25s are lovely. I did a lot of time on B-25s, and they're a fantastic aeroplane to fly. It brings in more of the team, you know, because you've got two pilots, you've got the ground crew on board, you can put loads of kit in it and go a long way. So that brings in a different element to the flying. If you go off, you know, in a single-seat Spitfire, it's just you. And so you can't, although you're sharing the experience of people on the ground watching you, you're not sharing it in any other way. So it's nice sometimes to, and that's where the Blenheim's particularly good, because there's three of you go somewhere and you're sharing the experience a bit more. When it comes to the aeroplanes that I mostly dislike, that's a very interesting one. Yeah, every now and again you get an aeroplane that you get out of and you just think, you know, did I enjoy that? Maybe not. And then you start to analyse why you didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
And you probably don't revisit it again. You know, it'll be for all sorts, and it can be any aeroplane. You know, it could be, there was a certain, this is going to really upset Oster people, but we had an Oster here which I loved. And then I flew a different mark, and I won't say which mark it was, and I got out and thought, that is really awful. I couldn't put my name on why that particular one of that particular model was awful, but it was. But all the other Osters I've flown have been lovely, and things like Piper Cubs are great. You know, you potter around with a Piper Cub. It's really good fun. But every now and again, there is one aeroplane, and it could be just that it's that particular machine.
Yeah.
You know, you can, years ago, I mean, I've done a lot of chipmunk flying, and there was one chipmunk I got out and thought, that thing's awful. You know, and we said to the owner, that doesn't fly like a regular chipmunk. And he said, that's all right, I've had it for 15 years. So yeah, well, you were used to it. But it was just, so you just get the oddities.
And are there any most underrated aircraft or any types that you perhaps you've changed your mind on? I mean, you said like the mid-war fighters that nobody kind of pays any attention and they're kind of forgotten about, despite being, you know, the link between World War I biplanes and the monoplanes of the Second World War.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of aeroplanes that you, like a chipmunk, I think a chipmunk is a completely underrated aeroplane by many people. It's such a lovely handling aeroplane. You know, it's light under controls, it'll do aerobatics all day long. A lovely little trainer. Some of the others, underrated aeroplanes. A T-28. Well, there's an underrated aeroplane. I mean, that will, we've had two of those in the past, and you know, they're fast, they're powerful, they'll do aerobatics all day long, they're easy to fly, so they're probably pretty much underrated. I mean, the only thing that is sort of stopping the progression on those more here now, and well in America too, is trying to get the engines overhauled. You know, it's a big problem. But that's certainly an underrated aeroplane. Some of them, you know, you look at and you think, they might look a bit like T-34 Mentor. Another very, very nice aeroplane to fly. Beautiful little aeroplane to fly. So yeah, there's some out there that really are, you think, wow, that's lovely.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
And what about Spitfire versus 109? We're in the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Britain this year. You've flown both.
Yeah.
So which which is your preference? Which would have the edge?
I've been lucky. Lots of people have compared Bouchons against Mark 9 Spitfires and the like, and I don't believe you can. So I've been lucky enough to fly an original 109E with a Daimler Benz, and I've been lucky enough to fly an original Mark 1 Spitfire with a two-pitch propeller and all of that sort of thing. So from the early 1940 design, I've flown both of them, and they are very comparable. I mean, the early 109 is very manoeuvrable.
Yeah.
It's quick, it's agile, it had good firepower. You put that against the early Spitfire, that is quick, yes, in a straight line, but its climb to height was weak. It had the two-pitch propeller, which was, you know, causing its own problems. The engine was suffering because of that, so they were blowing up engines, you know, very easily at the, you know, in the early 1940s, even to the extent that Dowding wrote to all the squadrons and said, "Stop blowing up my engines. You know, you're over-boosting them." Of course, things changed. So between Dunkirk and the Battle of Britain, there were constant speed units came on the propellers. They got 100-octane fuel, so they could run more boost. So it changed. But the Mark 1 like we had, N3200, and the 109E I flew, at the beginning, during Dunkirk, I can probably say I'd have preferred to be in the 109. Far more agile. But its big drawback was takeoff and landing.
Right,
it's horrendous on the ground. And from the point of view of an aeroplane looking after you, the Spitfire looks after you. You know, it talks to you. So a tired pilot, and of course they all were, they were exhausted. A 109 will bite you, whereas the Spitfire wouldn't, and nor would the Hurricane. So those pilots coming back off maybe the third or fourth sortie of a day, where they were completely worn out, they could, you know, come in, land, not, you know, of course a landing's a landing, but they would be far better off than the 109 guy trying to land a 109, where any moment that aeroplane's going to have a nibble at you. And if you weren't on top of it, you know, it could be disastrous. You know, and if you look through the records, there's a, you know, the Germans lost more 109s in ground accidents during the Battle of Britain than they did in combat. So it tells a story.
And talking about 109s or Bouchons, and not quite a Battle of Britain, but you flew the aerial flight sequences in a number of films. I mean, you mentioned and TV, so there was Peter Kane, and those days on Dunkirk. So,
yeah, I did a lot in Dunkirk.
So have you got any amusing behind-the-scenes stories of, from that? Because that was an epic for anyone loving Spitfires.
The majority of the work I did was in the 109. In fact, I did all the 109 flying in Dunkirk, because it was our 109 that was in the film. And lots of the low level across the water, especially out on the Isleimere, where they took all the small boats to the Isleimere, especially the filming boats, and most of the what was supposed to be the channel work was filmed there. Because they could sink the boats, and then it's only 12 feet deep. So in the evening, they'd send out cranes and refloat the boats. And the next day's filming would start all over again. But there were lots of, you know, occasions where sometimes you thought, I think I should have stayed on the ground, mostly because of weather. The weather would come in, and all around that part of the coast are these big wind turbines. And we were operating into Lelystad, and it's pretty much surrounded by wind turbines. So you needed to be careful. But then we were down in Leon Solent, going out over the Isle of Wight, operating all over the water out there, doing lots of air combat work and the like. Some of the most memorable things were trying to get the shot, of course, of the from the back of this. They had a Yak 18T converted So the front cockpit was made like a Spitfire cockpit.
Yeah.
And it was flown primarily from the rear cockpit. And then what they were using IMAX cameras. Well, the, I don't know if you know the size of an IMAX camera. It's a big lump of camera. And there are only apparently 11 of these cameras left in the world. These cameras have come off of the latest Star Wars film. And they mounted these things on this Yak-18T with the idea that one of the shots was the 109 coming up behind a Spitfire and it being shot down. And then another shot was the 109 coming up. So they got a full frontal of the 109, and then there'd be a Spitfire come from behind, zip through, and then smoke poured out the 109 as if it had been hit. And we were filming that from the back of this Yak-18T. Well, it could only do about 140 knots if it went into a dive first. And so I remember going out on one of the last shots we did, and we went out over the sea, and they said, we've got to get the shot, John, of you basically rolling
right
with smoke coming out right behind us. We need a full frame shot of this. So off we went, and they wanted the tail of the Yak in, because the tail had been made to look like a Spitfire.
Right, okay, yeah.
So off we went, and he dove down, and I followed pretty much with the throttle closed, and as he pulled up, then I'd throttle up, come roll right behind him, and that was meant to be the shot. Of course, my overtake and everything else was always causing me big problems, and they couldn't get the shot, and they couldn't get the shot. So finally we went back, and the director said, right, the pilot, you fly it from the front, I'm going to get in the back and look at the monitor, and I'll know then if I've got the shot or not. So off we went and we did this, and first couple of shots, didn't get it. And I'm looking at fuel, thinking, we need to get the shot. So I said to the lead pilot, right, just dive down, go a bit lower this time, and as you get at least 150 knots, you've got to get 150. And I will this time swoop in and I'll roll earlier. And
yeah.
I think we're going to get it. And I put a little bit of barrel in because it was much safer like that, because I could keep an eye on the back of his aeroplane, so I wasn't rolling blind. And it was a bit of an issue. You could just roll and the nose just blanked them out, which was always a worry, obviously, but it made you back off slightly, so you were absolutely sure you weren't going to hit him. So this time I thought, no, what I'll do is put a little bit of a barrel in here so I can see him. And so he dove down, pulled up. I was there, did the roll, got the little bit of barrel in, and went, well, within 5 feet of the back of this camera plane. And... And he called, he said, John, that was close. I said, no, I'd got you. He said, no, he said, it was close. We got the shot. But when I, you know, I was looking at this thing, thinking, please don't slow down anymore. And as I binned out of that manoeuvre, of course, now the 109 is down at 95 knots. The slats have come out. I'm now heading towards the sea. And I'm only at 600 feet.
Sheesh.
And I thought, I'm glad they got the shot. I'm not doing that again.
Did not have a zoom on the IMAX cameras. Did not kind of, did not suggest a zoom.
No, I'm actually a very wide shot, and that's what they wanted. But it's, so there was lots of exciting moments on the film. But it was really good fun. So that was the Warbird stuff. And then, from that, we actually got the flying on Dunkirk, we won the Hollywood Stunt Award for it.
Wow.
So out we went to Hollywood to get presented with the Stunt Award, and which was amazing. So, we all did well with that. And from that, then I got the job of going on to the latest Bond film, which was last year.
Wow.
So okay. I was out in Jamaica flying a Cessna 185 on amphibian floats.
Okay.
And doing the latest Bond film, which of course should have been out, but they've now delayed it until November. So I can't tell you what I'm doing in it.
Right.
For obvious reasons. that there is a Cessna 185 on floats in the Bond film.
We shall look out for that.
Which is all the flying that I was doing out there.
Okay. I'm conscious I've gone well over your time here, so I'll try and skip to the end. And I mean, you know, working on a piece of cake, that's one of my favourite
boots. As I said, I was flying a Harvard camera plane then, and that was my... I wasn't flying Warbirds at that time. I suppose Harvard is a Warbird, but you know what I mean. But that was very special, being with a lot of the boys, some of them who are not around anymore. You know, Ray Hanna, Hoof Proudfoot, John Watts. You know, we had a lot of fun, especially down at Friston, down on the south coast, where we would get airborne, literally turn left, and you were straight over the Seven Sisters. It was just phenomenal flying.
Yeah.
So a lot of fun, yeah.
I'll just kind of look into the future then. You talked about earlier about unfortunately furlough people, but you know, it seems to be sort of expanding in scope and here. I mean, what are you doing to encourage the next generation of Warbird technician and apprentices along and kind of a, you know, sort of, I suppose sort of increasing the diversity of people who might get into it. How do we excite the young people tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean,
say these aircraft are important. It's important actually that they're kind of kept flying.
Yeah, I mean, the NHS Spitfire is doing that for us right now. There are lots of youngsters are watching that and going, wow, I like that. But we've run our own apprenticeship scheme for the last 12 years. So we've had, you know, many youngsters through the shops. They've gone through a, you know, 5 or 6 year training program, and many of them are still with us. And they are the new generation of engineers for us. Because, you know, obviously the boys that used to do it are too old and retired or left this shore now. So they are the future. And we're doing the same with the flying. So we have some younger guys that are flying for us now. We're training those gradually through the processes of getting to know old aeroplanes, how to fly old aeroplanes, understanding the engineering of the old aeroplanes, and then getting them gradually into display flying and that sort of thing. The two-seat ride business, of course, creates the need for pilots to fly Spitfires. And so, whereas years ago we would suffer with currency for pilots.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'd have, maybe you'd got 5 pilots that flew for you, and you've got 1 Spitfire that did 25 hours a year.
Yeah.
And so to cover off currency for people was really hard. Now, these guys are clocking up 100 hours in a Spitfire each every year. So it's a big difference there. So currency in things like Spitfires is not a problem anymore. But we do have, you know, we've got the youngsters coming through. So for the future, we've got applications all the time from people that want to come in and have an apprenticeship with us. Of course, currently we've also got a huge number of applicants from engineers who have lost their jobs with various airlines or other organisations that want to come and work for us as well. We're not employing right now because that would be a silly thing to do. We're actually condensing slightly, so there will unfortunately be a few redundancies, but the idea is, because we're combining the two companies, which was happening ironically just before COVID hit us, you know, we're combining them in, all the store systems are everything being combined and all that type of thing. So where we had 2 stores people, we only need 1 and all that type of thing. So it's the combination of 2 companies joining into 1, with the idea that when we come out of this with 1 company, it'll be a company with all the right people working for it. We'll continue to do a good job, obviously, and that's what we want to do, and we'll move forward into whatever the future is going to hold with that in mind. The intention is not to grow it beyond its usability, is probably the best way of putting it. It's so easy to employ lots of people and do a lot of running.
Right.
Whereas actually, if you do a lot of walking, you end up with the same position financially, and actually you're probably enjoying it more.
So if I'm a young person, you know, or a boy or a girl, and I see, you know, NHS Spitfire on Instagram, and I go, oh, that looks a six-seating aeroplane. And I think, how do I? What would your advice be to someone who sort of thought, oh, you know, I really want to get into warbird restoration, warbird operating, warbird flying, and you know?
Oh, it's really starting. you know, pretty much they need to start how we all started, which is sweeping hangar floors and cleaning things. To be quite honest, many of the pilots here have been with us, you know, a long time, and that's how they started.
Yeah.
The new guys that are coming through, you know, they've gone through their engineering, they've got to know the aeroplanes. Some of the other new guys that don't work for the company but have, you know, they might be airline guys, but they've built their own RV-7 or something, and they've gone off and done formation aerobatics, and they've trained themselves to do air shows. And so the next step for them is to get into something a bit heavier and finally into a warbird. But they've done the course, so to speak. You know, they've we get so many offers by people saying, well, you know, I've been in the Air Force and now I'm flying airlines, but I'd love to come along and fly Spitfire. Well, I'm sure you would. But one, unfortunately, you wouldn't have the skills to do that unless you've been lucky enough to go through BVMF or something like that. And actually, if we're going to train somebody, so if we're going to take you in and train you, we've got to be absolutely sure that we're going to benefit as well. You know, this isn't just to put you in a Spitfire.
Yeah.
You know, so we need to see that they're going to be around for a long time. They're going to get to know the engineers well. The engineers actually are the first post that I look at in selecting new pilots, because when we have pilots come in and they trial us and we trial them, the first people I talk to is the engineers,
right?
Because they pick up straight away on somebody who is just a pilot as against an engineer pilot who will actually, when he lands, he might go and clean it,
or
he might, you know, the guy that just walks straight across to the crew room and gets himself a beer, fills out a bit of paper and goes home.
Yeah.
That's not the...
Having over rev the engine.
Yeah. So the one that's out there talking with the boys before he gets airborne, helping them feel it, helping them clean it, getting to know the aeroplane and having a care for it, they're the ones that will go on in this future.
Oh, okay. Fantastic. All right. And so I think the final question then is you know, what does the future hold for yourself and Arco, you know, going forward? I mean,
from the company point of view, pretty much as I described.
Yeah.
We will be, in terms of the number of people we've got on the wage list, we will be smaller. However, we're going to be better. We've got, you know, lots of things for the future going on. We've got, you know, great aeroplanes to maintain. The operation of it will build up once the air shows start again. We will look at air shows. We're not just going to go out and do all the air shows.
Yeah.
You know, we've already started that process of just doing the ones that, one, we wanted to do and enjoyed doing, and two, felt there was a genuine need for one of our aeroplanes.
Yeah.
You know, so, and we'll continue in that vein, but the majority of show work we do will be here, probably Old Warden and some of the ones that we've always loved to do. From my point of view, once I've got the, what will effectively be, not a new team, but it will be a slightly different team in place, and I can see that I'm confident in what they're up to and how they're running it, and how the operations are going, then I'm going to take a minor step back, just so I can, you know, go off and do a few more things with the family that I can't do now.
Mm. But just to remind our listeners, Duxford Air Show, September. That's when you're going to see the NHS Spitfire kind of
Closes the show both the Saturday and the Sunday with the Red Arrows.
Fantastic. John Romain, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
What a fabulous project and a company doing great things to keep some of those older aircraft operational and seen by the public. Very big thank you to John and the Aircraft Restoration Company team at Duxford for taking the time out for us. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We would also like to thank Mick Oakey and his team at the Aviation Historian for helping to promote the programme. If you enjoyed this episode or want to comment on the show, please give us some feedback on your app, our Facebook page, or on Twitter. You can always email us at getinvolved@aviation-extended.co.uk. You can find Extended now on all popular podcast players, including Apple and Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Player FM and Podbean. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find Tim at R-A-E-S, Tim R, on Twitter, and you can find Gareth on Twitter at Gareth_Stringer. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and on our Facebook page. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended!
This is XTP Media.